Masechet Kiddushin, the Tractate Kiddushin in the Babylonian Talmud. We read the first Mishnah, and then we proceeded on to the first piece of Gemara. Now, let me just review. There are some here who were not here last week, some who are here for the first time, just to give you a little bit of review of where we are. We started the course by looking at the way in which marriage is spoken of in the Torah. And we saw that there was a consistent use of certain Hebrew terminology for the descriptions of marriage. The classic line that is used, and that we found it again here in the Talmud, that is translated as to get married, is ki yikach ish isha, which is translated normally in English as when a man takes a wife. But what we tried to see was that that is a phrase that we are very familiar with, because we are familiar with the English translation of the Torah. But what I tried to show you that was that it is the Hebrew verb lakach, that from the earliest description of the creation of the world, in the creation of the first human being, the word lakach is used to describe the taking of the rib from Adam and the creation then of the woman as a separate creation. We then saw that there was a second stage to this, and that God brought Eve to Adam. He brought the two of them together, and that was the Hebrew verb lehavi, to bring. And I then described to you how in the classical Jewish structure of marriage, there are really two sides, two steps. One step is the lekicha, as it were, the taking, and that involves the rituals or the procedures that we call kiddushin or erusin. The first part of the wedding ceremony is called erusin, or sometimes interchangeably called kiddushin. And that part of the ceremony, until the Middle Ages, took place in day one of year one. The next part of the ceremony, what we call the chuppah, took place an entire year later. Okay? And I described to you how I think that the two parts of the ceremony really reflect the two words that we have in the story of creation, of lekicha, of taking, and then of bringing the bride to the groom. So that is a general background. Then we began to look at the formalities of the structure of the kiddushin, and here we'll just go through the Mishnah again. Aisha nikneh d'shalosh derachim. A woman is acquired in three ways, or a wife is acquired in three ways. The kona et atzma, and she acquires herself. This is page 2, side A. 2A. It is the first. I'm just reading the Mishnah. A woman is acquired in three ways, and she acquires herself in two ways. Nikneh b'cheset b'shtar u'b'ziyah. She is acquired through money, through shtar, through a written document, or through bi'ah, through sexual relations. B'cheset, when we say kesef, money, what do we mean by money? Beit Shammai Omrim, the school of Shammai says, Bidinar, u'bishabe dinar. For Shammai, it is a large amount of money called a dinar, or something that is worth a dinar. So it is not crucial that it be money per se, but something of value has to pass between the hands of the groom and the bride. Okay? Beit Hillel says, with a pruta, or something that is worth a pruta. Now, pruta is a very small amount of money. That is the smallest coinage that you have a pruta. Okay? So that's like saying a penny. As if it were a penny. And that is the difference between the two of them. The chama he pruta, and we saw that there's a discussion of how much there is a pruta. היא פרוטה אחד משמונה באיסר האיטלקי, 1/8 of an Italian איסר. וקונה את עצמה בגט. How does a woman acquire herself? Namely, how does she get out of the marriage? What way, once she is in a marriage, does she have to get out of it? And there are two ways. The get uva mitat haba. She can get a get, or if the husband dies. Now, I mentioned to you last time that you read that and don't take it for granted, because last time we discussed the alternate methods of breaking up a marriage, which was, as I described it, divorce Italian style. And if you saw the Marcello Mastroianni movie, you remember what that was. The only way that you can break up a marriage is death. And if, death. And the theme of that movie was, this guy couldn't stand to be married to his wife, and so he kept trying to shoot her. And every time he tried to shoot her, something happened, except it didn't work. That was divorce Italian. There is a divorce. There's only one method, though. It's mita. It's mita tabao. Well, you don't gain your own freedom from your own death, obviously. So it's the death of the spouse. The death of the spouse. And I say that to you because it's really a radical idea, if you think about it, that in a system where you would assume that God brings two parties together, I don't know how many of you know the Christian liturgy here, God who brings the two parties together, no man shall render asunder. Right? No man shall render asunder. That is to say, if God is involved and God is an absolute, and there is an absolute nature to the relationship of marriage which is sanctioned by the divine, then there's no way that you can unsanction it. And that's the Catholic Church's position till today. That is, till today, the Catholic Church's position. Of course, the get is written about in the Torah. So, from the very earliest stages of the development of Jewish law, there is a notion that marriage is a contractual relationship, and that, in fact, there are ways to enter into a contract, and there are ways to get out of a contract. And I just say that one should not take that fact for granted. Even the ways that you get out of the contract, the causes for divorce. Last week, who was it who told us what? There's Ira. I saw Ira come in. Ira, what did you say to us last week?
That New York State does not recognize common law marriage.
New York State does not recognize common law. So we'll get to that in a minute. But the recognition, let's say, the possibility of getting out of a marriage, of a divorce, for any grounds other than adultery, for example. When I grew up in New York State, there was only one grounds for adultery. When I was a kid, for divorce, not grounds for adultery. One grounds for divorce, which was adultery. And when we were kids, people used to disappear once in a while in the neighborhood, and we knew what it was all about. When our neighbors, I lived always among Catholics. I grew up with Catholics. They usually were Italian Catholics, sometimes they were Irish Catholics. But they were always Catholics. Well, it took me years to meet a Protestant. I thought Protestants were Jewish. I had no idea what they were. So I grew up with Catholics, and with Catholics, the people would disappear. It wouldn't make any difference. I mean, they were not Jews, or whoever it was. They would disappear. And we as kids learned that they would go to one of two places, either to Reno or Tijuana.
To Reno or where?
Tijuana. And the reason for that was that in New York State, you couldn't get divorced, because the only grounds for divorce were adultery, and nobody wanted to prove adultery, whether it was provable or not. That's just not the way people wanted to live their lives. So instead they went to Reno or they went to Tijuana, and then they would come back a few weeks later and they'd be divorced. So these are the things you learn as a little child, you know. But here the get is more or less what we would call a no-fault divorce. So not an awful lot different from the... it's somewhat different.
I grew up in a poor Catholic neighborhood, and they didn't go to Reno and what they used to sit with. And then they would
live
with someone else. There was no...
Because you couldn't get divorced. The church would not allow...
Well, you couldn't get divorced and you couldn't go anywhere.
So they split and then they went. And then they went for Sunday Mass. Still an issue. So I'm just saying that when you read these things, we shouldn't just take them for granted because we are so familiar with them. Really, much of the world functions very differently. Regardless of the historical context, I'll get to the historical context somewhat later this evening, but just in general, when we think conceptually about what marriage is a religious institution, it shouldn't be taken for granted that you can either have a contract to put it together or that a contract can be severed. But of course, you see that you can do that here. Okay? Then the last part of the Mishnah concerns the Yevama, Nikneh Viziyah, Vakol Nayat Atzman B'Chalitzah, V'Mitat HaYavam. This was the case of the levirate marriage, an unusual case in Jewish law, where a man and a woman are married, the man dies, the woman is left childless, she has not had any issue from this husband, and in fact then his brother is obligated to marry her. There is a way to get out of that. It is called chalitza, and that is mentioned here. But that's not going to concern us. I mean, in theory, it's all part of the way you can separate certain marriages, and among them is the levirate marriage, which is an unusual case, which we have in the Bible. We have it in rabbinic law. Eventually becomes forbidden in Jewish law. You cannot have a levirate marriage today. It is absolutely forbidden to conduct that in Jewish law. So that if a man and a woman are married, the husband dies childless, the woman is not allowed to marry his brother. Not allowed to marry his brother. Right? Forbidden. Although it is permitted here in the Talmud. Okay, then we read the Gemara, and the Gemara now goes into a comparison between chapter 1 of Kiddushin and chapter 2. And this is a classic way that the Talmud will analyze a legal subject, partly because it's a legal subject, and these kinds of issues, this way of doing things, is not strange for lawyers and judges, number one. Number two, I think that one of the things that the Talmud does, its own methodology is such that it is both legal and it develops over the course of a literary analysis. And here is very much, you'll see, a literary analysis. Why does the language appear this way here and that way there? How does it compare to the use of similar language elsewhere in the Talmud or elsewhere in the Bible? This is classic rabbinics, but it's not only legal, it's partly literary. And I think that what we see happening here is that as we compare literary sources, one of the things that we learn is that we flesh out ideas. We see the way ideas are used in different times and different places. And that just helps us to have a broader conception of what it is that we're talking about. So we saw that the Gemara begins, Aisha Niknet, the woman is acquired, the wife is acquired, Maishna Hachadatani Aisha Niknet, Maishna Hatam Detani Aish Mekadesh. In our chapter, the first chapter of Kiddushin, the formulation of the law is the woman is acquired. The second chapter of Kiddushin has a different piece of law, but it says it totally differently. It says, Ha'ish Mekadesh. First of all, not the man, but it starts, not the woman, but it starts with the man. Secondly, instead of using the verb kana to acquire, it uses the phrase lekadesh, something like to sanctify, whatever that means. So I ask, why the difference? Mishum dekaba elenitne kesef vechesef minalan. Because in chapter 1, the Mishnah wants to teach us something about kesef. It knows the procedures for the acquisition of a husband and a wife. Those procedures involve kesef, money. Right? In order to state that, is going to want to talk about kesef, and when you're talking about kesef, the obvious thing is to use the verb kana, to acquire. The kesef minalan. And how do we know that kesef, money, is a part of marriage? What does money have to do with marriage? Well, it's all learned from verses. Gamar kicha kicha mi sedei achron. It is learned from the use of kicha, the verb to take, in the story of Abraham's acquisition of ground to bury Sarah, which happens to be, of all things, this week's Torah portion. Okay, this is the Torah portion that we're going to read on Shabbat. So there Abraham buys the field from Ephron the Hittite, and there it says, Kativhatan natati kesef hasadeh, kach mimeni. I give you money for the field. Take it from me. Kach mimeni, kach. Lakach, lakachat, to take. So there we have the verb to take. To take is used in connection with money. Okay? And then earlier, ki, kach, ish, isha. When we see marriage mentioned in the Torah, the way in which it is mentioned is when a man takes a wife. Ki, kach, ish, isha. Okay? And taking is kinyan. It is an acquisition. Taking really is a synonym for lakachat, to acquire. Because the same language is used. The field that Abraham kana, he acquired. So lakachat, to take. And to acquire a synonym. They are used interchangeably in this week's Torah portion to describe the acquisition of this piece of land. Okay? And since lakachet is also used in terms of take a wife, the language there, the symbolic activity then is kesef. Kesef symbolizes the transition between one state and another state. After all, that is the purpose of a contract. This we talked about last time too, that the making of a contract is to a very great extent something that happens that is verifiable either because it's written down or that it has been witnessed by appropriate witnesses, and therefore there is a change of status that in fact has credibility to it. And that is what is true in commercial law. It is true in family law as well. The key issue in commercial law is when have you purchased something? And we have to be very clear about when you purchase something. Is it when you pay your money? Is it when you receive your goods? That's an interesting thing, buying on the internet. You buy on the internet. You do all of your purchasing on a credit card. What if you don't get the product? Is it your fault or is it their fault? So you're saying there's no law. This is a crucial issue that we have today. It's happened to me a few times in the last year. I ordered something on the internet and I didn't get it. So my worry was, did I lose or did the company lose?
Did you get charged?
Of course I got charged. Okay. But the question is, once I called the company, you know, companies, generally reputable companies, of course, they realize that they don't want me. And if UPS lost it, let's say, they make a claim against UPS. I might make a claim against UPS. But if that's the case, I'm never going to buy from that company again. Right? I want that company to take responsibility. So you see the way in which procedures are sort of developing because we have a new way of acquiring things. But it's true. Excuse me? Thank you very much. Okay, very good. Very good. Yes?
You know, today everything has to be in writing, but you know, if you've been doing business for a while, you always say, oh, you remember when it was just, you could do things on a handshake with your word, with your bond.
Yep.
Is there a basic handshake in
the... We'll get to that probably today. You'll see, and the Talmud is going to ask the question, can you do this change of status with a handshake? Why not? Because there are certain transactions that, in fact, you can conduct with a handshake. And the Talmud will raise, why is it that you can't conduct this transaction with a handshake? So it is actually an important question, okay? So, you see, it's the nature of the transaction, the fact that you have to have a transaction of some kind, and that there has to be some verifiability, or there appears to be some verifiability of the transaction. Jewish law, by the way, the verifiability is usually not the written contract. It's not the writing of the contract. It's the witnessing of the contract. That's the key thing. Of course, the witnessing of the contract is written into the contract. But here, if you make your erusin, your kiddushin, on the basis of the transfer of a ring, for example, which has value, from one party to another party, there's nothing written. Absolutely nothing written.
That's in the chuppah you do it, so that's a year later.
No, that's, we put it a year later. They are assuming that it's being done, this is the very first erusin. This is the erusin. Is the giving of the ring? We today use a ring. You don't have to use a ring. You could use
anything.
You could use a purta. All right, just a purta. That's what the Mishnah says. So you could use it, and then you give it to the groom gives it to the bride. You say, "Harei at mekudeshet li bifrut the kesef zah." With this ring, with this money, I thee wed. Is it kosher? It's kosher if it's witnessed, not if it's not witnessed. Okay? If it's witnessed, then it's a kosher contract. Every contract needs witnesses. So it has to have the witnesses.
You do it with the ring, you have to have the
Shabbat. Correct. And, well, that's our procedure. The truth is you don't have to do it because there's a certain assumption that you could always check it out afterwards.
Yeah, I remember my father.
But I always do that in a wedding. Any of you been to a wedding at which I've conducted?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, your daughter. Right.
What did Paul say? It is
that you have to ask whether the ring is worth a fruta. You remember me doing that? Sure, I did that. I call it. I take the ring. I say, "Can I have the ring?" Give you the ring, and I said, wherever the witnesses are, I said, in your opinion, is this ring worth at least about 2 cents? And I can assure you, in that wedding, it was worth at least 2 cents. There's no problem. We moved on, and then we made the kiddushin. It was very kosher. We had witnesses, and it was proper. Yes.
That's the transfer of money of its equivalent. Not involve the future father-in-law?
Nope. I'm glad you raised that. And we're going to get back to that. Because I think that's a very important point. Notice no mention has been made in the Mishnah whatsoever of the future father-in-law. Again, one shouldn't take that for granted. I would bet that half of us probably think that it's really a transaction between a father and maybe the groom. But notice that there is no mention whatsoever of any parent. It's an astounding thing if you think about it. If you would assume that in a traditional society that the parent is not involved, forget the parent of the groom. The parent of the bride. The parent of the bride is not involved. I haven't seen a word about that. Correct. Nothing. There's no mention whatsoever of a dowry here at all. Correct. You're right. Now, eventually, there comes to be a traditional dowry. There is a dowry in Jewish law, but as far as the law is concerned, we see no mention of it, and the marriage is not dependent upon it at all. It may become a matter of custom. Custom may eventually have the force of law. But we see that in the law itself, as it is stated in the Mishnah, in fact, as it governs
this is the law of marriage. It says nothing about that.
I remember, maybe, so I didn't miss the number, that if there is difficulty in a family, that the daughter's dowry is precedent over the son's inheritance.
That is correct. That is correct. That is correct. She inherits first. She inherits first. So that these are crucial issues. They're side issues in a way, because dowry, you see, is not crucial to the kiddushin itself, but you're absolutely right. Yes. Nidunya means a dowry. Nidunya means a dowry. And we see that the nidunya is not discussed as far as the procedures of the kiddushin are concerned. They are not relevant to the kiddushin itself. Okay?
Is it the case that, let's say, in this area of the commissioner, that all legal codes of this area also have laws for marriage?
I get to that. Okay, let's go on a little bit further.
My right? question is, I'm not clear on this argument and terminology of cock, domain, are they showing that marriage is a form of acquisition because Chesed is involved, and in the same way that Abraham paid money to acquire the field? Or are they saying Chesed is a valid means of making acquisition with the state because that's how Abraham acquired the field, and since the Torah
I am arguing the latter. The latter, right, and not the former. Correct. Correct. That what we are dealing with is precisely the way you stated it in the second half of what you had said. Okay? Okay.
I like that.
I like it a lot better, too. Okay. All right. So, Tani Aisha Niknit. So now we know why in our Mishnah it talks about Aisha Niknet, the woman is acquired, the wife is acquired, rather than Ha'ish or Nikadesh, rather than the use of the verb Likadesh, Likadesh. V'nitne hatam Ha'ish koneh. Well, so then the Mishnah now says, if the verb koneh, acquiring, is so good and so relevant, why doesn't the second chapter of Kiddushin begin that way? Why does it use a totally different piece of terminology, Lekadesh, when it has a perfectly good term, which is used in chapter 1, namely Koneh? Okay. Ne ikaratani lishne diaraita. Somehow the Gemara says, when we see the discussion in the first chapter, namely where we are, the language of the Torah is used. The language of the Torah is nikne, to acquire. Lakachat, to take or to acquire, that's Torah language. Ulevasov tani lishne v'rabbanan. And the second mention, namely in chapter 2, the rabbis use rabbinic Hebrew, lekadesh. Okay, that's a rabbinic terminology for marriage. Now, of course, with the rabbinic terminology for marriage, kiddushin, or Likadesh as the actual verb, not such a bad idea. It's a wonderful idea, because that, in theory, leads us to the notion of sanctification. Right? There is a holiness to it. But even the sanctification and the holiness that we use in English is really very much a result of our conceptions that are Christian conceptions of holiness. Because Kiddushin in Hebrew, and the word kadosh in Hebrew, means holy, but it means something else at the same time. And that is what is articulated here. Levasov tani lishne derabanan, umay lishne derabanan. What is the meaning of this rabbinic language? Lekadesh. Diasala akuli alma kehektesh. The woman becomes uniquely related to the man, and prohibited to everyone else, as is the case of Hektesh. Hektesh, you remember, is property that is owned by the temple. When property is owned by the temple, you can offer anything that you want to the temple. Let's say you want to offer your books to the temple. Okay, you give your books to the temple. After you give your books to the temple, you can't go and read them. Because then you're using the temple's property. It's God's property. If it's God's property, you've got to handle God's property differently. Okay? So there is a uniqueness of relationship, which is a relationship between God and his property. And here, the force of kiddushin is that there is a uniqueness of relations, an exclusivity to the relationship. And it's a very exclusive relationship, at least as far as the woman is concerned, that once people are married, they are exclusively available to each other. Now, in their time, of course, there was an exception to that because it was a polygamous society. So there, it is not as egalitarian as we like to think of it as. Surely wasn't, because it's a polygamous society. A polygamous society, a man can have more than one wife. So that was the nature of that society. But certainly as they articulate it now, there is an exclusivity to the relationship. And the word lekadesh, kadosh, while it has that overtone of holiness, also has a very clear overtone of exclusivity. Okay? Now you see that in the course of our discussion here, I've simply reviewed the things that we read last time. And in the course of doing a little bit of literary analysis, we've really ranged over a number of other subjects. And we kind of established a few different spheres. The notion of acquisition, the idea of holiness, the notion of exclusivity. All of these things have come not from a narrative that was designed to develop a discussion about marriage, but rather in the Talmud's own unique way of taking the words of the Mishnah in chapter 1, going to chapter 2, and then comparing the two of them together. So you see that you sort of elaborate something, but you do it the long way. And it is not the short way. Now let's go on. Alright. In the second chapter, we now understand why it can use the verb lekadesh, to sanctify. You understand that? So there it is. The man is the subject, ha'ish, lekadesh. And then there's the verb. So why not have the same structure in chapter 1? Chapter 1 says, Isha nikneh, the woman is acquired. Why not say the man acquires? If we are establishing that it's supposed to say acquire, why not say the man acquires instead of the woman is acquired? Why not say it that way? Okay? Nishum bekabai lenitneh sefer v'kona et asma bedidah. The Gemara answers, because the Mishnah wants to teach us the latter part of that first Mishnah, which is that she can acquire herself. Since the focus really is on the woman who is able to acquire herself, therefore it has a certain consistency, just as a formalistic consistency, that the woman is now the subject in both parts of the Mishnah. All right? The woman is acquired and the woman acquires. All right? So we see now the force of the latter part, that the woman can acquire herself. The nitne ha'ish kone umakne. Oh, well, if you're going to say the second half, we need it for the second half of the first mission, which is that a woman acquires herself, why not say the man causes her to acquire? You could also do that. It's valid Hebrew. Ha'ish makne. Have it all in the man. The man does this, the man does that. Why have it in terms of the woman? Okay? Mishum d'ika mitvat habal. Because, in truth, the man doesn't actually do something, he dies. And you don't do something to die. Alright? In the Gemara, v'ashkacham derech d'ikre. No, I'm sorry, I must have skipped something here. Where did I go? Oh, I'm sorry, I went to the next page instead of the next side of the page. Mishum de'ika mitatabal. The lav ihu kamatne. A man doesn't acquire his own death. That's the basic idea in Judaism. God brings death, we don't. Okay? We are not responsible for death. The ibayet ema, or if you want, I can give you another reason why, again, we do not put the second half of the first Mishnah in terms of the husband, but instead it's all in terms of the wife. Itana koneh hava amina afilu ba'al korcha. If we were to put the whole first Mishnah in terms of the husband, and we were to say ha'ish koneh, the man acquires, hava amina afilu ba'al korcha, I would have said even against her own wishes. Therefore, Tana ha'isha mitnit. Therefore, it is written that the woman is acquired de midiata ein shel. What is this?
Ein
shel midata. De midata in shalom midata la. If she agrees to it, she's acquired. But if she doesn't agree to it, she's not acquired. Realize what the Talmud has just done. It really took a major issue that we should have been thinking about, and it extrapolated it from simply, again, a literary analysis here. Because the interesting question to think about is, does a woman have any say in this matter? You're talking the ancient world, my friend. It could very well be that she has no say in the matter. Either that she has no say if a man wants her, he's got her. Or there are other possibilities. That if her father agrees to it, if her brother agrees to it, she's simply not a willing party to this, and that it's irrelevant to the nature of the contract. But here, again, as a result of the language, we see that a woman's consent is a necessary part of what happens here. Now, having said that, I want to reflect a little bit on the historical context. In truth, we know a fair amount about marriage in the ancient world, because the classical writers wrote about marriage, both in terms of the dramatic explication of either ideas or drama itself. It's much ancient drama. And we have ancient law codes as well. So I want to spend a few minutes just thinking comparatively. And that was the question that you raised before, Dan. What do we know about the ancient world, which is more or less contemporaneous with this, about the forms of marriage, how you become married, or what the issues are, at least, in the development of the structures of marriage? The earliest one that I wanted to bring to your attention was really in his own life rather late, but it is the discussion of marriage that we have in Plato's Laws. Plato wrote the Laws late in his life, about 360 BCE. So in truth, this is prior to the Talmudic period. Talmudic period at its earliest goes back to about 200 BCE. So, this is 360. Excuse me?
360
plus 200. BCE. This is BCE, before the coming of the Christian era. So, this is, as I said, somewhat before the Talmudic period, although I found, generally speaking, that Plato's analyses of things are usually so good that if Credo says it, people probably until yesterday are saying the same thing. Plato, you could do worse things than spend the rest of your life reading Plato. Plato is one of the great, great, great writers in all of history. And I must say, every time I go back to Plato, I find that it is some of the most worthwhile time I can ever spend. If you think that the issues of our modern world, let's say the social issues or the issues of, well, what are burning issues in our time, women's rights, homosexuality, all those things, if you think these are new issues, all I have to say is read Plato. Plato said everything that has to be said on that subject, and nothing new has been written in the last 2,400 years. That's a little different, of course, but basically all the points were made by Plato. Now, Plato, in the Laws, as I said, later in his life, Plato writes a large number of dialogues. Marriage comes up in the dialogues, but it's not a major subject. But in the Laws, which is the last of his it's more than a dialogue, it's a trilogue, Plato sets this in terms of the foundation of a city, and what should be the laws of the foundation of a good city. You know, it's still, you know, I don't know that we have ever progressed. I mean, that still has to be some of our basic questions. What is the foundation of a good city? And he talks about the nature of the family in the city. The family is a central constituent institution of the city. And then he goes on to, well, let me some of his ordinances, this is of the good leader, will relate to contracts of marriage, which they make with one another, and then to the procreation and education of children, both male and female. The duty of the lawgiver will be to take charge of his citizens in youth and age and at every time of life. There's very good ideas about patronage. Later on, this is book one of the Laws. He talks about some of the more legal sides of things. The betrothal by a father shall be valid in the first degree, that by a grandfather in the second degree, and in the third degree, betrothal by brothers who have the same father. If there are none of these alive, the betrothal by a mother shall be valid in like manner. This is interesting here. You know who's left out?
The
woman. The woman is left out. The woman is left out. Again, you know, you read this, and that perfect sounds good, but there's somebody left out. The woman is the one who is left out. I'll read that again. The betrothal by a father shall be valid in the first degree, that by a grandfather in the second degree, and in the third degree, betrothal by brothers who have the same father. The brothers who have the same father means a woman, the same father as the woman,
as the bride.
Because there could be half-brothers. And so the power is given, in fact, to her brothers. Okay?
Blood brothers.
Her blood brothers, correct. The brothers who have the same father. Assuming the father is dead. Assuming the father is dead. If the father is dead and there are brothers, assuming that those brothers are her brothers, then they have certain rights. In cases of unexampled fatality, the next of kin and the guardian shall have authority. In other words, if none of these normal relationships exist for whatever reason, then the next of kin and the guardian shall have authority. So interesting.
But was the age of betrothal the same thing?
We have no idea here. We have no idea. Well, I shouldn't say no idea. We have some idea. You'll see later on, trozol, generally speaking in the ancient world, there are three possible thresholds for betrothal. One is child betrothal. Okay? And you have child betrothal in the Torah, too. And there the father has the right. The father has the right to betroth the daughter. Okay? Interestingly enough, in the Torah, the daughter also has the right to deny the father's betrothal when she reaches age. That's called a niyum in the Torah, which is extraordinary. It's just an amazing thing that you have that. The woman has a right of niyum, which is to, again, when she reaches age, to go contrary to the father's decision. The second time of betrothal is at puberty. Okay? And commonly either that's 12 or 12 and a half. In Jewish law, there are two stages of puberty. One is 12, I'm talking to a woman, 12, and then the time between 12 and 12 and a half is when a woman is called a na'ara. She's a na'ara, and then, because before that she's a yalda, then she's a na'ara, at 12 and a half, she becomes an isha. Okay? And that's the third stage, would be from that point on, from the age of 12 and a half on. And because they're really seen as stages where the father has different levels of control. Certainly as far as the minor goes, the father has control. Here, it's not exactly clear, but it is clear in that there is no case where the father doesn't have control, whatever that is. He says earlier on, let me see if I can find it for you. No, I can't find it for you, but the sense here is that the bride and the bridegroom are probably, I would say, not so different from Jewish law. In the Talmud, the assumption is that the time of marriage is roughly 18 to 20. So, and we keep that in mind too. The assumption in the Talmud is not that marriage is childbirth marriage, nor at the age of puberty. So marriage is assumed to take place at about 18 to 22, actually. That's the age for marriage that you have in the Mishnah. Okay, I'm going a little further here. Next again. What are to be the rights before marriages or any other sacred acts relating either to future, present, or past marriages shall be referred to the interpreters, and he who follows their advice may be satisfied. Therefore, according to Plato, the forms, the procedures of marriage will be developed by the statesman in any society. He doesn't give you the procedures. Touching the marriage festival, they shall assemble not more than 5 male and 5 female friends of both families, and a like number of members of the family of either sex, and no man shall spend more than his means will allow. He who is of the richest class may spend a mina, he who is of the second half a mina, in the same proportion as the census of each decreases. All men shall praise him who is obedient to the law. But he who is disobedient shall be punished by the guardians of the law as a man wanting in true taste and uninstructed in the laws of bridal song. So here he is putting a stricture on overspending on weddings. Drunkenness is always improper, except at the festivals of the god who gave wine, and peculiarly dangerous when a man is engaged in the business of marriage. At such a crisis of their lives, a bride and a groom ought to have all their wits about themselves. They ought to take care that their offspring may be born of reasonable beings. For on what day or night heaven will give them increase, who can say? In other words, once they're married, they may produce children. that they produce children in a state of drunkenness, not good for anybody, including the children. Moreover, they ought not to be begetting their children, their bodies are dissipated by intoxication, that their offspring should be compact and solid, quiet and compounded properly, whereas the drunkard is all abroad in all his actions, and beside himself both in body and soul. Wherefore also the drunken man is bad. Do you see the interest of Plato here? A lot is said about proper behavior at the wedding, the amount of money spent at a wedding, but the procedures are all to be discussed. They're not matters of virtue. These are matters of virtuous behavior, and therefore they're interest of Plato. Now, in truth, the real contemporaries of the Talmudic tradition are not so much Plato, even though I think Plato and the Platonic tradition is crucial for the entire Hellenistic world. The real contemporary is Roman law, because Roman law is alive and well and functioning at the very time of the Mishnah. And Roman law has been studied in comparison to Jewish law. Here I wanted to bring to your attention the two volumes that were published by Professor Boaz Cohen. Boaz Cohen was professor of Roman and Jewish law at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He had just stopped teaching when I came to the seminary. This was his academic field, Roman law and Jewish law. These two volumes are a comparison between the two fields of Roman law and Jewish law. Some work has been done since, but remarkably little. Quite interesting, although Boaz Cohen did it, still it seems to me there's so much work that could and should be done in that field, that remarkably little has gone on in Roman law and Jewish law. But Cohen has, by the way, if you want to buy this, it's very expensive today. I bought this for a pittance when I was a student, and I just went on the internet to see whether you could buy it, and the only place you can buy it, at least what I saw, was on eBay. They're selling it on eBay for $135 a volume. I didn't pay $135. I can assure you that. So he has a chapter in volume one of his book on Jewish and Roman law. And there he describes many similarities between the two. I want to read you a little bit from an article on Roman law, Roman family law. Marriage often coincided with the beginning of adulthood for girls and was symbolized with that transition. Marriages were arranged between the bride's father and her husband-to-be. The father also had the power to end the marriage in divorce. That's key point number one. Again, that it is the father of the bride who is the key player. And the bride is really totally subject to the father. And that's, I think, what is so unusual in the Mishnah that we have, that the father plays no role in the Mishnah. However, there are three ways that marriage can be made: by usus, cohabitation; by conferiatio, a religious ceremony; and by coemptio, purchase. So here you see some analogy for kesef, shtar, and bia. Certainly the two kesef and bia, marriage through the passage of something of value, and the cohabitation, that is the same in both. The religious ceremony, that's not clear. I don't know really what's being referred to by that. In marriage involving the usurps, the father of the bride relinquishes his control over his daughter to the new husband. It always is required that the woman had to remain and stay in her husband's house for 1 year, cohabiting with him, assuming the position of daughter in the family. Fascinating. We also have a 1 year, but it is a 1 year where they do not stay together. That is, in comparison between Roman and Jewish law, there is a 1 year period, but the 1 year period in Roman law is that she goes into his household. In Jewish law, there's a 1 year period, you go through the kiddushin, then he goes home to his family, she goes home to her family, and there is no coming together until a year later when there is the chuppah.
Same in India?
I couldn't tell you. My knowledge of Indian law is limited. I'm sure that it's possible to research that. It would be interesting to see it and to compare it. But these two here are contemporaneous. So I think that really I find it just fascinating to even have this notion of the year, but it's so very different. It's really so different. Marriage by confiratio, that is a religious ceremony, involves a religious ceremony. This type of marriage is usually reserved for the wealthy. It's also very important. Reserved for the wealthy. Keep that in mind when you see the argument between Shammai and Hillel. Realize that one of the things that we don't think about is in fact the nature of weddings for the wealthy and for the poor. And probably one of the things going on in the argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel is that, as we know, Dr. Finkelstein wrote two volumes on the Pharisees. My teacher, the late Professor Lee Finkelstein, wrote two volumes on the Pharisees. His argument then, and it has since been proven to be an oversimplification, was that Shammai represented the wealthier classes. Hillel represented the poorer classes of people. And eventually the school of Hillel is the one that becomes the dominant school. Here, I think it holds. This is a perfect example of what Finkelstein was arguing, that in Roman law, this third possibility was really for the rich. Probably what you have going on in that argument between Shammai and Hillel is an effort by Hillel to say that all of the rites and rituals should be available to everybody and there shouldn't be a difference between the rich and the poor. So I think that that's probably what one of the things that's involved here. After Augustus, marriage was a formal requirement only, but was still required for what was called manus. A woman married with coemptio. Coemptio is translated here as purchase. So that is our kesef, as it were, was symbolically purchased by her new husband from her father. That's fascinating. Even if there is a notion of purchase here, in Roman law, you purchase the woman from her father. Even if one were to say that you had a similar notion in Jewish law, which I was arguing against, you would purchase the woman from whom? From herself. From herself. So she did not become a slave to her new husband, but he had total control over her. She was his property. All women had to have a guardian who handled their finances and legal affairs. It was a Roman ideal that affection between the husband and the wife should develop after marriage. Conjugal love was something that should be calm and non-disturbing, something to be cultivated. That should have in the Jewish notion as well. So I think that the similarity is that you do have three methods. You do have a statement of three methods for the making of the marriage, but I think at the same time that the distinctions are really quite stark and quite amazing. And any questions on that?
Since they lived together.
In Roman law?
Well, the Jews in Palestine lived among Romans. The Jews were aware of the differences, I would imagine. So, in a way, it's almost like the Jewish law is a reaction against
mm-hmm.
something perceived as immoral.
Let me prove you what you... Alan Mayer was with me when we went to Tzipori. He went to the town of Tzipori, which is where the rabbis of the Talmud lived. Many of them lived in Tzipori. And Rabbi Judah the Prince lived some of the time in Tzipori. And you go to Tzipori and you see where the rabbis live. And then you see there's a Roman stadium, which is 5 minutes walk from where the rabbis live, the rabbis of the Talmud. So the point that you are making, that they lived close to each other, is so true that it's almost overwhelming that they lived so close to each other. Now, you might have thought that, well, yes, these were two, you know, one lived in one place, one in another place, that there had been some cross-cultural contact. The truth is, they lived the same block. They were down the block from each other, and it's not as if they were really separated. They were in a stadium there. A Roman stadium where they served the gladiators. So what are they doing in those stadiums? Stadia. That was right down the block. So it must be that a fair amount of what you have here is in fact a reaction against what the Romans were doing. Because it cannot be that they didn't know what was going on. I mean, these are intellectuals. They understand law. And I cannot imagine that they did not understand what the Romans' procedures. We have evidence of this. You'll see it further on in Kiddushin. The rabbis, where is it here? It's a, yeah, this is Boaz Kohn. The rabbis, after tracing the source of a threefold manner of betrothal erisim, he's saying that the Romans have a forms of betrothal. And of course, our literature, what happens is that each of the forms of betrothal has to be traced to the Torah. It can't be an innovation. Rather, as we've just seen, we saw the tracing of Kesef, and that was derived from the verses of the Torah. In Elamazeth, tracing the sources of the threefold manner of betrothal, erisim, to several biblical verses, raised the following query. Thus far, we have learned from the form of betrothal in Jewish law, but how is it with the Gentiles? Right, they're asking a question about what the Gentiles. To which Rabbi Abahu, in the name of Rabbi Eliezer, replied, sexual commerce with the married, but not a betrothed woman, constitutes adultery in their law. In other words, the Gentiles, meaning the Romans, do have a notion of adultery with a woman who is a married woman, but not a betrothed woman. And remember, I explained to you that after erisim, if she were to have sexual relations with somebody other than the betrothed, it would be a case of adultery. The man, if it was a man from the outside who would have relations with her, he is subject to the death penalty. She is subject to the death penalty, right? Very severe. Okay? You're not allowed to have relations with a betrothed woman. And a betrothed woman, however, in Roman law, was not considered adultery. And finally, they conclude, sexual relations, Rabbi Eliezer replied, sexual commerce with a married but not a betrothed woman constitutes adultery in their law. And finally, they conclude in a quite categorical fashion that betrothal has no legal significance in the pagan legal economy. Quote, this is, I think, from Yerushalmi, yes, the Jerusalem Talmud, Hare lamadnu goyim en lehem kiddushin. So the language there is the Gentiles do not have a notion of kiddushin. Okay? So, in fact, from the rabbi's perspective, they saw themselves as really doing something that was different, because there is this intermediate state of kiddushin, which is not part of the Gentile procedure, as far as they were concerned. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah.
I'm confused about what we're saying the rabbis did, which was in reaction to the Roman way. Because to suggest that what they're doing is different from the Romans almost implies that it used to be our way, but only by seeing it
mm-hmm.
in Roman society did we realize we should mm-hmm. change it. I mean, how do we know that mm-hmm. these aren't practices which predated?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So that one would assume, as I said, for example, the notion of marriage and the woman is a party to a marriage. There's certainly no notion in the Torah that that's not the case. And in Talmudic law, it's the same as in the Torah. I assume that for the yalda, yes, the father has control, but for the post-pubescent woman, the father has no control at all. And that appears to be the case in the Torah. So I think that what you are finding here is a way of articulating it, that there are three forms. There are three forms. And those forms are illustrated, even though there were three forms in Roman law. They are articulated in a way that I think can be conceived of as a reaction from Roman law or against Roman law. Not that the concept is new, but the way in which it is articulated is new, because the way it's articulated is also somewhat like the Roman law. Okay? Thank you for pushing that redefinition.
It seems to me that the money is in the Roman law sanctioned by marriage.
No. I don't really know. I honestly don't know, because I don't know enough about the Roman law. I can't say.
I think that the origin of the construction is the other construction of the Roman law, the pater familias.
Correct.
The father of the family has the right of life and death over everybody in the family. So it's releasing this power in the 1 year period.
Yeah, that's a good. That's
the phase of the Roman law.
Very good. Very nice. Very nice. The pater familias in Roman law means that the father is absolute power. And that means power over life and death, just as you explained it. And I think that that's a good way to think, then, of the transition, because if the starting point is different, no longer have the pater familias who has the absolute power. Instead, you have a new starting point, and that is the husband.
And we have to remember that the Romans themselves 300-400 years of the legal tradition around this time.
Correct.
And the Jews were quite old, the rest of the society is quite modern.
That's also true. That's a good point.
So close for Romans, it's a higher military structure, maybe.
Yeah.
But the social structure and social construction is just 400 years old.
That's true, although...
Close to the tribe.
Although, I would say that probably Roman law was influenced by Greek law also, which is older than that. That's why I brought in the Plato, because I think that the conception that you have in Greece, though you don't have a direct legal development, I think you have a social development from Greece through to Rome. Yes?
And that sounds also about the father. Did you say that is a period of the year that she's in her husband's according to Roman law, and she's treated as a daughter?
That's what I read, correct. And I'm not really sure what that means.
Exactly what you said.
Correct.
It's sort of a break
to the new family.
Relationship to the father.
It's very likely, yes. So from one father to the other father.
Right.
And then eventually to the husband.
And becomes the wife.
Correct. Very nice. Very good. Okay. Back to the Talmud. Back to the Talmud. And the Talmud is going to continue on this same type of analysis in order to abstract additional information. Right? Now we have learned that the woman's consent is crucial. We've learned that from the way in which data, because it's Aisha Niknet, and we don't have the husband as being the kone. Now, in all truth, if you ask me whether this is absolutely, whether the meaning of the Hebrew really forces this issue, frankly, I don't think it does at all. I think that what is happening here is that the rabbis in the Talmud are sort of playing around with the Hebrew in order to teach a variety of legal principles that, in fact, are relevant to the notion of marriage. One is that the consent it requires her consent, and that it's her consent, not someone else's consent. Okay, now we go on. Umay irya datami shalosh. Now, the Klara begins several asugya. Asugya means one idea over several different paragraphs of the language of shalosh derachim. Isha nitnet bi the shalosh derachim. A woman is acquired in shalosh derachim. Now look what the Talmud says. Shalosh derachim, three ways. My area, the tani shalosh. Why is it taught shalosh in the feminine? Litne shlosha. It should be taught shlosha, masculine. It should be taught in the shlosha, masculine. Derachim, the Hebrew plural of derachim, is a masculine plural. Derech, maybe yes, maybe no, you'll see. Right? You speak modern Hebrew, they did. They knew the Hebrew of the Bible.
Usually the plural in Hebrew is always masculine.
Usually always.
Yes. All right.
Okay, but that's not particularly relevant as far as Rachim though. Rachim is just roads, the paths, the ways, okay? So now you have to litnei shlosha. Why doesn't it say shlosha on the masculine? Mishum v'kabayil litnei derech. Shalosh is used because they wanted to use the word derech. The derech l'shon nekevahi. They're like you. They say derech is a feminine word. Just because it has a masculine plural doesn't mean that it's a feminine word. It's derechim kavot. Right? It's on you like shanim tavot. Right? We say shana shanim. You don't say shanot. You say shana shanim.
Derech
achat. Derech achat. Okay? So they know what you do. Derech lashon nekevah. Dichtiv, because it is written, okay, written in the Torah, v'hodata lehem et aderech yelchu ba. You shall teach them the road that they shall walk on it.
That
is feminine. If it were masculine, it would be bo. But it's da, feminine. So don't you know Hebrew? That's what the Talmud is saying. Of course it's feminine. It should be shalosh because it's, here you have a source in the Torah that says it's feminine. All right? Ve'ela. Had Tanya, the Shiva Drachim Bodkim Kazat. But you know, it is written in another Mishnah. In the laws of the Zav, the Zav is somebody who has an unusual issue from the male member. From the, it's a form of gonorrhea. Okay? There's some type of issue like gonorrhea. So, the Shiva Drachim Bodkim Kazat. In seven ways you check the zav, the person who has this issue. It's an issue, it's a subject in the Torah, it's a subject in the Talmud, because the Torah says that somebody who has such issues is subject to a ritual impurity, which means the person can't go into the temple unless certain procedures would be followed. So you have to know whether you're in that state or not, or if you are, how to get out of it. Okay? So it says Shiva Derachim, which is the male. You already told me it's female. And now here the Mishnah comes somewhere else and says it in the masculine. Shiva Derachim. All right? Nifnei Sheva. It should have said Sheva Derachim. It should have said it in the feminine. All right? Rishon Dekabai Lemifnei Derech. All right? There, the masculine numeral is used because the Mishnah wants to teach the word derech. The Ashkacham derech to ikre lishon zachat. And there are, in fact, places where the word derech is used in the masculine, even in the Bible, in the Torah. יכתיב בדרך אחד יצאו אליך ובשבעה דרכים ינוסו לפניך. Alright, that's the Torah. Deuteronomy 28. Shiv'ah drachim. Shiv'ah drachim. Masculine shiv'ah. So in the same Torah, sometimes it's feminine and sometimes it's masculine. In the Mishnah, sometimes it's feminine and sometimes it's masculine. Okay? And Moses didn't know the grammar. He didn't know. Iachi kashukra'eya hadadeh, the Gemara then says, if it is true the way you are citing scripture in one place contradicts scripture in another place. Not only that, the kashinami matnitana hadadeh, not only is scripture contradictory, the Mishnah itself is contradictory. Right? One Mishnah contradicts another Mishnah. How could that be? Right. If it could be, because we know what he assumes is consistency. The Bible knows what it's saying. God knew what he was saying. Moses knew grammar. Moses knew grammar. Right? And Rabbi Judah the Prince didn't know grammar. He didn't know Hebrew. Come on. Okay, but there's a contradiction now. So we'll have to explain away. Can't be a contradiction. We'll have to explain it away. The fact that scripture seems to be contradictory is not really contradictory. It will show us why. Here, in the first instance that we had, it's the Torah. And in the Torah, it's feminine. Torah is feminine itself. It's talking about teaching. In the first instance where we were looking at it and it was feminine, it was talking about the teaching. And teaching is a feminine word. It's Torah. It doesn't only mean the Torah, but it means teaching in general. And that is a feminine word. So where it is referring to something that is an essentially a feminine thing, it uses the feminine. Okay? To functionality in the context, the context determines. Whereas in the second instance, which was the case in Deuteronomy, where it is talking about a wartime situation, Darko shel ish la'asot melchama. It is the way of a man to make war. The aim Darko shel isha la'asot melchama. And it's not the way of a woman to make war. Right? This is, you're going to wonder about your next president, maybe. Okay?
Is
the way Milchama feminine? Milchama is feminine. Don't get technical with me. The issue is, who makes war? Does a woman make war? A man? Are women are peace loving. We all know that women are wonderful, they're good, they want everyone to get along with everybody else. Men are impossible. Men cause wars. Okay? So that explains it. Explain the jokes. Don't explain it at all. That's a terrible way to explain it. Okay? So, of course, the Talmud is also not happy with this. So the Talmud goes on. No, the Talmud doesn't do that yet. Well, wait a minute. Because the Talmud, of course, has got to explain the other contradiction. We only know at least one way to solve the contradiction between two verses in the Torah. Now we're going to find a way to solve the contradiction between two verses in the Mishnah. Okay? That's that. Hacha delagabe isha ka'e. Here, when we're talking about ha'isha niknet, a woman is acquired, who are we talking about, a man or a woman? A woman. So you think it should be masculine or feminine? Feminine, of course. Tabis. Alright? So there, and then we're talking about this man who has a gonorrheal issue. Alright? Is it a man or a woman? A man. So when you talk about a man, it's masculine. When you talk about a woman, it's feminine. Right? That's a very bad argument. Very bad argument. Notice what's happening here. You have a literary problem. You have a problem with grammar. And we're learning all kinds of weird things. That's what we learn about men make war, women don't make war. we're learning about gonorrhea. How many times you thought about gonorrhea before I came to here tonight? And then gonorrhea, and in order to go into the temple, you have to do these things. All these things. Oh, goodness. All right. Now the Gemara says, how do we know that the Mishnah in Zavim refers only to a man? Woman could have problems like that of that nature.
She doesn't go to the temple.
No, she also has to go to the temple. Isn't that true? Well, you think that because you grew up Orthodox. But it's not true.
Wow.
Talmud doesn't know about that. So women went to the temple. We also went to the temple. Okay. Yeah, I could have told you that because it's true. It's in the temple, they were together. Okay. In the Mishnah, of course, it's talking about a woman. There in the Mishnah concerning a Zav with a convict. That's what I just said. Okay. How do we know that the Mishnah in Zavim refers only to a man? Right, that's true. How do we know it refers only to a man? A woman could have an issue like similar to that, let's say, possibly. The darko shall ishli badek, because it is the way of a man to check these things out. That is to say, it is not usual for men to have things coming out of their genitals. You'll excuse me here if I tell you what it says. It's not usual for it to happen to men, for men just to happen. Whereas the Engar Kashel Ishali Babek, but a woman doesn't normally check these things because it's usual. If I had an old sinful woman, a woman menstruates. Okay? A man has no similar thing happening. Okay? Therefore, the Ha Isha Name Ba'onis Mitama, a woman becomes Tame'a only through something unusual were to happen. It's not normal and you'd have to check it. In an odd way. Tani Lishon Zachar. Therefore, when it talks about this issue of a man, it is exclusively talking about, because it's talking about checking. And women just have different ways of relating to those things than men do. Okay?
What?
The
worldly badek, Zachar, even though it's done for a man,
it's a feminine word. It's what?
Dika.
Yes.
It's a feminine.
Yeah, but it's, remember, it was Shiva de Dikot. I'm sorry, Shiva Drachim. It was in seven ways, and it was masculine, that the Zav checks himself. Right? He has seven ways of checking himself. So there, the issue, now, the key thing to think about here, and the broaching an issue, it's actually going to be developed over the next short while. The argument here is that the thing that is natural is what determines. It is what is natural that determines it. Namely, the agreement of language is connected with the way things actually happen naturally, common and accepted ways. Okay? So keep this in mind, because as we see more examples that will be brought up, this issue of what is natural is going to be a relevant issue. Okay? Let's just see if I can go quickly. Now the Mishnah goes on. My tamatane shalosh. Right? The Mishnah uses the word shalosh for derachim in our Mishnah. Yishum derachim. Because of the word dachim, nitne devarim. Oh, why not use, instead of, if we say shalosh, well, why did we have to say derachim in the first place? You and I are analyzing drachim. Derech is male and female. Why do we have to get involved with this in the first place? Let's use another Hebrew word, devarim, things. Things. Because what could you have said? There are three things you have to do in order to acquire a wife. Three things. Why do we have to say three ways?
There are alternatives.
Well, could be things are alternatives. Possible. Look at the argument here. Okay, nitne devarim, nitne shlosha. And then if it were three things, it would be shlosha. It would be masculine. Everything would be clear. Mishum de kabai limitne bi'ah. Because, in fact, it wanted to teach bi'ah was one of the things, cohabitation. U'bi'ah ikre derech. And cohabitation is considered a derech, a thing, because it's a biblical verse. Tichvi, derech gever bi'alma, kein derech isha mena'afet. Now the key thing is the first part. It is the way of a man with a woman.
The distinction between doing versus things, objects.
Maybe. I want to go a little further. I'm running out of time. Let me just get to the end. Hatenach via. That's fine for cohabitation, but why not kesef ushtar my ikalamema? It is true that cohabitation is natural, but then we should have stuck with the word for, you know, we have three things. Two of them, kesef and shtar, are not natural. They're things. Bia is natural, but if you have two things that are things and one that is natural, and you use derech for the thing that's natural, you have two as opposed to one, what should you use? You should use the two and not the one. I'm going to stop here in just a moment. Let me just sum up. One of the things that the Gemara now is doing is that the Gemara has said that derech is natural. And one of the things that we have to keep in mind here also is that there is a concept here of nature being a part of marriage. You know, we tend to think of these things outside of nature, as if they are a structure for some societal purpose. What the Gemara has done, again in a very odd fashion, is to tell us that the use of the word derech is crucial here. And the derech is crucial because derech is used for things that happen in a natural way. And that nature is one basic part of marriage. It is not all of marriage. There are two other things that are there. There is contract, but marriage is partly contract and partly nature. Right? And it wasn't until we had that introduced through the analysis of the masculine or feminine use of derech that we even got to the idea of nature. We haven't thought about that yet. Again, you see the way in which the Talmud doesn't raise an issue in a normal developmental pattern of discussing an issue, but instead, through the use of language, we've now expanded our concept actually to the way in which marriage is partly a natural phenomenon through its sexual aspect.
That also explains the subliminal of those associations of men with perhaps issue and women looking at themselves are natural.
Exactly right.
Why would they start introducing such items?
That's exactly right. But that's why, that is then why you have, they're called derachim. They're called derech. And this whole thing now, the whole form of the Mishnah, is not as a thing, it's not as if it's something objective, it's part of nature. It uses the language of derech. Exactly.
Derech also means process.
You'll actually see what you said, Solomon, which you're saying now, it's going to come up later. And the Mara actually wants to further develop that. But, you know, as you go through this, what happens is that the Mara sort of builds its flower of a concept by just going in strange directions, but adding to our notion of what the concept is. See you next week.
I was asking earlier before I fell asleep, what's the story about law and bringing it back to that?